gathering with a group of friends in a park, going for a picnic. As long as you are vaccinated and outdoors, you can do it without a mask. The CDC is able to make this announcement because our scientists are convinced by the data that the odds of getting or giving the virus to others is very, very low if you're both been fully vaccinated and out in the open air.
President Biden yesterday reiterating new CDC guidance about wearing masks outdoors. Fully vaccinated Americans no longer have to wear a mask when they're outside alone. The agency also gave the okay for vaccinated people to attend small outdoor gatherings without masks, even if some of the attendees are unvaccinated. There's a big caveat, though, and that is everyone should still wear masks when they're in crowds. But in a county of more than 10 million people, what's a crowd? Especially as LA County nears the least restrictive tier in the state's reopening plan and more people resume pre-pandemic activities. Joining me to discuss is Omi Garner, Director of Clinical Microbiology for the UCLA Health System. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madeline. Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you. Well, the CDC issued its guidelines and also issued a handy-dandy guide, a graphic, if you will, of what you can and cannot do. It's extensive. What is your take on this, new guidance?
Well, my first take is hopeful, right? I feel that the data is becoming stronger and stronger, as President Biden mentioned, as Dr. Fauci mentioned, that people who are vaccinated are at very, very low risk of getting the virus, but also very, very low risk of giving the virus to somebody else. And so I think these recommendations are definitely a positive. That said, at the same time, I think they can be a little bit confusing.
Yeah, I agree, which is why we invited you on the show to help try to ease this confusion. So I'm looking at this guide right now, and there are all sorts of things you can do when you're fully vaccinated and don't have to wear a mask outdoors, and a bunch of stuff indoors where you still have to wear a mask if you're fully vaccinated. I guess my first question is, why? If you're fully vaccinated, why can't you do what you did before the pandemic?
Well, you know, I think that the answer to that is a couple of fold. So one, I think it's interesting. We have to think about the previous guidelines. So if you remember the previous guidelines that came out for vaccinated individuals, it said that vaccinated individuals can gather inside without masks on. And this is what we've been living with for a little bit of time now. So as the new recommendations come out, I think the new recommendations are really to set continued recommendations for unvaccinated people. So what this means to me is that if I'm indoors in a large group or medium-sized group, you know, I'm kind of having trouble defining what the group size is, but if I'm indoors in multiple household groups, the reason why as a vaccinated person I have a mask on is to just encourage everybody to wear a mask. Because to me, what we're protecting now are unvaccinated individuals. Unvaccinated individuals from getting the virus and unvaccinated individuals from giving the virus to another unvaccinated individual. So I really think of it more as like a public health measure where I'm vaccinated and I'm wearing a mask just to encourage overall indoor mask usage, because we know everybody isn't vaccinated yet and people are still at risk for this very serious disease.
Right. But in terms of your own personal safety, you are not safer necessarily with a mask on if you're fully vaccinated and you're with an unvaccinated person. I know there are a few breakthrough cases, but they're extremely rare. You can be without a mask indoors with an unvaccinated person and be safe.
Yes. You know, as you mentioned, it's not 100%. And there are certain populations that may not make an appropriate response to the vaccine. So, you know, if I'm somebody who's severely immune compromised and I've had the vaccine, maybe I make the choice to continue to wear the mask because I'm not sure about my own individual level of protection. But generally, I agree with you. A vaccinated individual can be around an unvaccinated individual without a mask on and not worry about contracting the disease just because those cases are so rare.
Indoors and outdoors.
indoors and outdoors. I think the main concern, again, is that inside spaces, unvaccinated individuals can lead to higher concentrations of virus. Now, does that mean more breakthrough for vaccinated individuals? I haven't seen any data around that, but it's creating an environment of mask usage inside just because we haven't reached that, let's say, 80% overall vaccination rate yet.
Right. What about going to Dodger Stadium and you're fully vaccinated? Mask or no mask?
So I'm having a problem taking my mask off at any time right now. Sort of a, you know, what we've been through over the past year.
Right.
I still, as a vaccinated individual, find myself having a mask on. And, you know, I know that Dodger Stadium, I believe, has vaccinated areas where they are increasing the number of people. So if you're talking about my own comfort level, if I'm going to be around a lot of people, will I still wear a mask even outside? I probably will, but that's more of a behavior modification than it is with my own safety. I think that in an outdoor setting, being fully vaccinated, I am safe without a mask on. Will I still wear it? It's going to take me a little while to come back off of the mask wearing around groups of people, to be honest.
Yeah. So, but as you say, that's psychological, not necessarily in the scientific data.
That's correct.
That you might get the
that's
disease.
Correct.
Right. Yes, so that leads us back to my original question. Why not just say, CDC, to all people who are vaccinated, go ahead, live your life?
Because I think the CDC takes it that that also gives license unintended for unvaccinated people to participate in the same behavior. And even though they're saying specifically vaccinated people, you know, I think that they're being as cautious as possible with the approach so that potentially unvaccinated people don't make that decision. Because there's nothing that shows who's vaccinated, who's unvaccinated, right? We're not showing off our vaccine cards. There's nothing that when you see somebody walking by you says their vaccine status. So not that I'm encouraging that to happen, but I think that's why the CDC is being slower in its recommendation rollout for behavior changes for vaccinated individuals, is to protect the unvaccinated from a disease that is, I mean, as we've seen, devastating an entire country in India right now. So, you know, we still have to stay vigilant for our unvaccinated population because we always sort of teeter on this edge of them getting disease. And the other thing I think we've learned is that younger populations are not protected from extended illness. Younger populations can have very severe disease, and that is our largest unvaccinated population at this point. So I think they're trying to do behavior control based on their recommendations, really targeted at the unvaccinated populations.
Right. So when someone like Joe Rogan says that young people don't need to get vaccinated, and he's an extremely popular podcast host, what does that do for the public health?
Sets us back. You know, I think it's unfortunate that that happened. You're talking about somebody who has millions of followers from a podcast perspective, and they're in that, you know, 18 to 30 age range. And I think they're going to believe that advice, and it's bad advice. And so it continues our pandemic. It continues to put people at risk. And I think it's unfortunate that that happened, that that is a common sentiment sometimes in the popular media, is that young people are not at risk for disease and will not have serious long-term effects from the disease.
Omai, it's always great to speak with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I always appreciate it.
That's Omai Garner. He's Director of Clinical Microbiology for the UCLA Health System. Well, early on in the pandemic, when we knew really nothing about how coronavirus spread, hygiene theater was in maximum overdrive. Remember wiping down every counter, tabletop, doorknob, disinfecting our groceries? A lot of that overdrive turned out to be overkill, and many of those pandemic habits, though, may be hard to break. We might have to, though, because some germs are good germs, microbes and bacteria that protect our bodies and keep us healthy. Earlier this year, a group of scientists published concerns about the effects of all this sanitizing and spraying down once the pandemic ends. Brett Finlay is a microbiologist and immunologist at the University of British Columbia and one of the authors of that study, and he's here now. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks, Madeline.
So a big part of your concern is what all of this sanitizing is doing to the human microbiome. Remind us what that is.
Yeah, so the microbiome is a technical term that refers to basically all the microbes living in and on you. So it's bacteria, it's fungi, it's viruses. And this is just normal. As soon as you're born, you acquire these things and they're with you for life. And just part of the collective being of being human is being coated in microbes.
And how do they protect us from illness and disease?
Well, as you know, I mean, most people, when you say microbes, they think disease, infectious diseases, tuberculosis, cholera, things like this. But there's actually only a small number of microbes that actually cause disease, about 100 in people. Yet we have thousands of species living in and on us. Over the last decade, we've come to realize these things actually serve a function. For example, brain development, intestinal development, immune system development, they're all involved in early life and getting your body going the right way. And we know if you deprive them of those microbes, you become more asthmatic or obese or something like that. And then as life goes on, in diseases that we previously didn't think were caused by microbes, like cardiovascular disease, like obesity, like Alzheimer's, these things now in the last decade or so have been shown to have microbial involvement. And so they play a phenomenal role in both human health and disease that we really didn't appreciate until the last few years.
And so is the hypothesis that once we overly sanitize, we then become more susceptible to these kinds of diseases like obesity, Alzheimer's, and autoimmune diseases?
Yeah, I mean, there's this thing called the hygiene hypothesis that really states we're just living too cleanly now. And so, as you know, 125 years ago, Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur showed that microbes cause disease. And then Pasteur showed that if you killed them, you pasteurized them, you didn't get disease. So we went on a war against microbes because we would then solve infectious disease. We brought in sanitation and antibiotics and vaccines. And when you look at the infectious disease rate today, it's actually quite low. But going in the opposite direction is all these other what we call non-communicable diseases. So that's obesity and diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, and Alzheimer's. And what we now realize is that in our quest to clean the world up, we're actually wiping out the good microbes as well. So the lack of these good microbes and the increase of these not so good microbes seems to be involved in causing these diseases that we really didn't see much of before. So what we were worried about with respect to this current pandemic and what we're doing to ourselves is that we are screwing up the normal microbes and we could see detrimental effects down the road.
And especially for little kids, right? Because a lot of this resistance is created when we're young and we're ingesting dirt and meeting new people and petting dogs and kissing cats and things like that. That can actually be beneficial. But if we are separated, as many kids were for the entire year, from their peers in preschool or grade school, could that have a damaging effect on their health in later years?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I wrote a book called Let Them Eat Dirt. And it's not about dirt. It's about the microbes in the dirt, with the idea that, you know, that we are actually keeping our kids too hygienic and they need these microbes. Just to give an example, if you're born by a cesarean section instead of vaginal birth, you have about a 25 to 30% higher chance of being asthmatic later in life and about a 30% higher chance of becoming obese. So these early microbes are really, really important for kid development. And then the other aspect of this is the other bookend of life, and that's the elders. And these have been disproportionately hit with COVID, and they've been locked in places for, you know, a year as well. And we know that they need microbial exposure to promote healthy aging. And so the bookends of life, the early and the late people are the ones that are really being affected the most due to the COVID hygiene stuff.
But at the same time, flu this season and colds, they've been practically non-existent, which is a good thing, right?
In theory, yes, you're completely right. And that proves that, you know, hygiene works in terms of infectious diseases. And we kind of expected this. We saw this with SARS as well. We had that a while ago. So yes, those are down. But also what's down is what you don't see is that's the transmission of beneficial microbes. Like when you kiss a person, you transfer 80 million microbes just with that simple act. And we've, you know, we've all been living in these cocoons the last year. And so we're not getting normal microbial exposure. And as you say, a new kid born into this world, yeah, they might not get a cold, but they're not getting all the other microbes that they normally also get if they went to daycare and things. So that's where our concerns are, that you're just not getting exposure to the normal microbes.
So what should be done? Should we stop spraying everything? Should we go kiss a whole bunch of people? Once we're vaccinated.
Once you're vaccinated, of course. Yeah, 2 weeks after. So I guess I want to make two points here. One is be aware of what we're doing. And then secondly, well, there are kind of ways you can think about repairing it. I mean, you can't go and kiss a bunch of people, but you can still go in your backyard and hug your dog and, you know, talk to people in your bubble and, you know, transmit microbes that way. You can think about your diet, which is the biggest way to improve your microbes, you know, the Mediterranean diet style, as opposed to white sugar, white flour type diets, that really has a beneficial effect on microbes. And so there are some things you can do, I think, even being aware of it. That said, we've had to do this because that was our only control measure for COVID. And, you know, we needed to do that. But as a result, we got to think about these unintended consequences we didn't really think about so much when we went into lockdown, and see if we can't repair them in certain ways.
Well, is there anything that you think we should keep? Should we keep washing our hands for 20 seconds and washing them a lot? Should we wear masks occasionally when we're sick or if we're in crowded conditions after we've all been vaccinated? Like, what do you think we should keep that won't really do damage to the microbiome?
Yeah, well, you're talking to a microbiologist who spent the last 10 years trying to convince people to get dirty in terms of microbes. And so I think you really need to think about microbial exposures. And, you know, ironically, travel is probably good because you pick up microbes from other places, hopefully not the infectious kind, but you expose that. So I think, you know, the wearing of masks and the excessive hand sanitizer use, I personally think this is not how we evolved. We've evolved to be exposed to microbes. And if we don't have the serious life-threatening infectious diseases around, then there's no reason to be wearing these masks and washing our hands and avoiding contact. Although it'll be interesting to see, you know, I know that when you stand near a stranger now, you kind of stand back. So I think our society's a bit changed. We're going to be a bit off about sharing microbes. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Brett Finlay, microbiologist at the University of British Columbia and author of Let Them Eat Dirt, How Microbes Can Make Your Child Healthier. Brett, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Coming up, the Inland Empire has some of the worst air pollution in the country. A big reason for that? Amazon. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Inland Empire has the worst air in the country. That's according to the American Lung Association's annual State of the Air report. San Bernardino ranks number one. Riverside ranks number two on the list for ozone pollution. One of the reasons, Amazon and other retailers who've built massive warehouses there, meaning lots and lots of diesel trucks in and out. And that has led to a big rise in respiratory diseases, particularly in children. Tech reporter April Glazer investigated this for NBC News. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks, Madeline.
Well, how many warehouses and other facilities have been built recently in those two counties?
I mean, it's hard to say how many because it's so many. But we do know that since 2012, Amazon now has 19 warehouses in the region. It's one of its largest clusters in the country. Walmart has six. San Bernardino County alone, the city of San Bernardino, rather, has over 70. So we're talking about Wow. A ton of shipping warehouses. And a lot of this is from online orders like Amazon.
Yeah.
And Amazon is also the largest employer. I'm sorry. I should add. I forgot to add.
Yeah. Yes. So there's a tension there, right, between the jobs. They say they've created, what, tens of thousands of jobs just in that area?
Yeah, 40,000 jobs in the region alone. Wow.
Okay. So it has these jobs. So that is something, I guess, that's welcomed in the community. But at the same time, as you say, all of this air pollution, how is that playing out? How are kids in particular getting sick from this?
Right. Well, the rise in warehouses has correlated with a rise in pulmonary diseases like asthma and bronchitis, and even some cancers, you know, not in kids. But there has been a rise, particularly in asthma and bronchitis and other kind of pulmonary issues that allergies with people in the region, including kids. And it's incredibly troubling because what happens is in order to have these warehouses, to have them work, you know, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of diesel truck trips going throughout the day in these areas. And a lot of these warehouses are, you know, just blocks from high schools. They're incredibly close to people's homes. In many cases, like in Fontana, they're actually offering to buy people's homes in order to put warehouses in, you know, kind of pretty residential areas.
Can't Amazon and these other retailers switch to electric or natural gas trucks?
I mean, they are investing in that, right? I mean, Amazon did say in February that they ordered hundreds, I think 700 medium and heavy duty cargo trucks that will be low emission. But that's nationwide, is my understanding. And that's only a fraction of the 30,000 trucks that the company has, not including the, another 30,000 trucks from companies that it partners with, right? And so 700 just isn't a lot. I mean, for the facility that Amazon is building in San Bernardino Airport, right, for its cargo and for its fast two-day shipping alone expects 500 truck trips a day. So, you know, the other thing to realize is that a lot of these warehouses, they don't own their own truck fleets. So it is a bit complicated because the warehouses don't necessarily own the trucks they operate.
Right. So then that would get into where the government would regulate the emissions, right? So what's happening on that front?
Yeah, so actually pretty soon on May 7th, some pretty drastic rules are up for a vote by the regional air quality regulator. And those rules would actually govern warehouses and say that warehouses of a certain size, I think it's 100,000 square feet. Again, these are really big warehouses. Warehouses of a certain size would have to adhere to certain standards that would lower its emissions, right? That's including truck traffic, you know, maybe changing to electric, you know, changing the types of equipment it uses, just basically making them less environmentally hazardous for the region. And if they don't adhere to those rules, they'll have to pay a fine. Now, those rules aren't in place yet. And, you know, the real estate associations locally and folks that represent the warehouses are opposing them. But local environmental groups and community groups and neighborhood groups are, you know, very much supporting those rules. They are drastic, but, you know, so is the situation there.
Well, is the fear on the economic side that these rules would dissuade companies from locating there and would have a negative effect on jobs? Is that the fear?
Yeah, well, the fear is that right now we need to have as many jobs as possible is what, you know, one person told me who works on behalf of, you know, the Southern California kind of real estate association that represents warehouses in the area, that we really don't need to be doing anything that would dissuade creating more jobs in the region. But it's also advocates are saying that it's hard to imagine things getting much worse air quality wise. And if something's not done, if these warehouses don't change their behavior, it's going to become increasingly difficult to live there. And the issue is that in this particular, you know, part of the of Southern California, the Inland Empire, people are low income often and don't have the money to get up and move. So they just have to live with this bad air quality.
Right. So this is an issue of environmental justice that we've heard about, that these things happen disproportionately in Black and brown communities.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, local neighborhood advocates are saying. They're saying that, you know, the pulmonary diseases that are cropping up in much higher numbers than in the rest of the state of California are affecting disproportionately Latino and, you know, communities of color in the region and low income communities, you know, much more than the kind of the white affluent neighborhoods. I mean, if we look at Fontana, for example, most of the warehouses are in South Fontana. That's primarily people of color in that region, not in other parts of the city that are wealthier.
Right. And so does this have the potential of really becoming a big problem for Amazon? We saw recently how much negative press they got with this union drive, which they were successful in squelching that. But still, there was a lot of negative publicity surrounding Amazon. How are they viewing this from a public relations perspective?
You know, Amazon is saying that it's investing in electric vehicles. As I said, you know, 700, they said, were purchased of these, like, you know, heavy duty trucks in February. But again, you know, that's out of 30,000 it owns, not including another 30,000. It could be a bad public relations nightmare for Amazon, but Amazon is also so incredibly big that it just doesn't have a lot of competition when it comes to, you know, fast turnaround two-day online orders. So it's hard to say how this will hurt Amazon, but Amazon has invested greatly in the region. Like I said, 19 warehouses plus an airport hub. So, you know, if the company is forced to kind of refashion its operations in the region, it will be costly, but it's hard to see it divesting when it's already put so much in there. It just seems like, you know, local community members, as well as the people who are proposing these rules, the air quality board, are saying that the way things are done has to change, not necessarily that the company has to go.
April Glazer, investigative reporter for NBC News. And for more of her reporting on this and other issues, go to NBCnews.com. April, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, how to bake with something other than white flour.
These are flours that look different, smell different, feel different. So they are completely captivating. Like when we are baking with whole grain flours, we are fully engaged in the process.
Los Angeles pastry chef Roxana Julipad is here to talk about her new cookbook next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, at the bakery and cafe Friends and Family in East Hollywood, you can find all sorts of yummy pastries, and usually they have a little twist. There are Sonora wheat croissants, banana bread and pancakes made with buckwheat flour, rye flour, chocolate chip cookies. Friends and Family is run by Roxana Julipat. She worked under Nancy Silverton at Campanile, then as pastry chef at Luke and AOC. But it wasn't until after those jobs that she discovered a passion for using ancient and heirloom grains in her baked goods. Now she has a new cookbook to help us all do it too. The book is called Mother Grains, Recipes for the Grain Revolution. And yeah, the idea of venturing beyond the old all-purpose flour bag may sound intimidating, but Roxana is here to demystify the ancient grain. Welcome to Press Play, Roxana.
Thank you. So great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, what is an ancient grain?
Well, ancient grain is this kind of this name that we've decided to call all these species that are indeed ancient. So genetically, scientists have actually been able to trace their origins of these seeds and realize that they have been around humans for millennia. We call them ancient because they are also pretty close to the original, meaning that they haven't been modified to sort of suit our agricultural needs of the present day.
So you talk about eight of them in your book: barley, buckwheat, corn, oats, rice, rye, sorghum, and wheat. And how did you choose those eight?
So the first thing that we can say about these eight grains is that, well, like we mentioned, first of all, they are all ancient grains. So we can say that they have all played a vital role in domestic agriculture or world agriculture. But second, we can definitely say that the majority of farmers who grow these grains are doing an outstanding job of seed saving. And also in areas like land stewardship and grain husbandry. And then lastly, I could definitely say that these grains can be adequately grown in the U.S. with a lesser eco footprint. So it seems like this is eight strong major grains that other cultivars stem from that we want to underline. So I call them mother grains, thinking like the way we refer to the main sauces in French cuisine, like mother sauces. These are like our mother grains.
Hmm. I see. So these are the bases for all the other grain products, I guess, or grain dishes.
Sure. And this is true, especially here in the U.S., specifically, and more strongly in the U.S.
Well, why is it that we usually just use white all-purpose flour, and that's our default. It seems exotic almost to try to cook with something called sorghum. I don't even know what sorghum is. Hopefully you'll enlighten me. But before we get there, why is it that all-purpose white flour is dominant?
I mean, what's more compelling than to call an ingredient all-purpose, right? Doesn't it sound like it will solve all of your problems? And indeed, it does. It's a flour that has been designed to execute and fulfill many purposes. Indeed, it's very efficient, it's very predictable, it's also very easy to ensure its supply, right? So yes, you would say, but we have something good, why change it? We have to question why, where does this all-purpose come from and what was it before it was all-purpose? And in creating that sort of like generic melting pot of flour that is just multifunctional and a solution to all and every purpose, we have missed an opportunity to really appreciate texture, flavor, history from other wheat varietals. And that's just covering wheat, right? Mm. So what if we were just pursuing a more pure form of food, like these grains that are unaltered?
Right. And so when was your aha moment? When did you think, oh, there's a whole world out there that I don't even know about? I need to go find out more about it and start cooking with these other grains. How did you come to that?
Well, there were a couple of things. I think that I always had it built in because I grew up outside of the United States. I lived all of my childhood in Costa Rica, where we eat a lot of corn products. So I had a lot of vocabulary when it came to other grains. Also, the Costa Rican diet relies heavily on rice. We eat rice pretty much for almost every single meal. So I felt like I had like more of these tools in my toolbox when it came to talking about other grains. So what became really interesting when like grains really, really knocked on my door, because it kind of like just happened to me, was the fact that I was able to I connected that grains are actually produce, that they are an agricultural product, that they do come from the field. And it was a moment in time when a few of the farmers I work with here and at the farmers market started to collect or harvest a few of the grains that they use as cover crops. And yeah, that's kind of like, it was a trickling effect. It wasn't all like, here, bag of flour, go bake something delicious. It was more like, hey, what you got there? Let's make something fun with it. And it really, really was kind of like a process rather than a bam.
All right, let's get into one of your recipes. Let's begin with chocolate chip cookies, because everyone loves a chocolate chip cookie. And probably most of us have made a chocolate chip cookie in our life.
I hope.
And most of us have used all-purpose flour when making said chocolate chip cookies. But you have recipes for all sorts of different grains, including, as I mentioned earlier, good old sorghum. Now is your opportunity to enlighten us as to the delights of sorghum and tell us what sorghum is.
Right. So because I had been a baker for so many years before I more purposefully started to incorporate grains in my baking, I had a lot of tricks. I had a lot of knowledge. I had also a lot of recipes. So I knew that there would come a moment where I would have to do one recipe that was almost good for every grain, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can prove this theory. I know I can. And I was like, okay, let's go with that quintessential bake that we all know and love and see what happens. And I think I've made this recipe with pretty much every grain that someone has put in front of me. And for sure, what was really cool about sorghum was that I was actually trying to make a gluten-free version of my chocolate chip cookie for a friend who actually cannot eat gluten. And I don't do this a lot. I don't try to reinvent my recipes as gluten-free, but sorghum is a really valuable flour when it comes to people that have gluten intolerances or celiac disease or Crohn's disease. What is really special about it is that it has a lot of texture. When it is whole grain, it actually does have a fair amount of bran and that is palatable and really actually kind of desirable. It also is a very neutral tasting flour, so meaning that it won't have a very pronounced flavor. So you can really, really just bank on the deliciousness of the chocolate and the mix of brown sugar and vanilla and let the cookie just be that.
And sorghum is, it just comes, it's a plant, right? And it's not, it's kind of like a corn, looks like a corn plant.
Yeah. So it kind of has a little stalk that has that little, almost like a corn in the cob kind of thing with multiple little buds at the end. What's really, I mean, sorghum is special for a long, many, many reasons. I call it the grain of the future because I really want to be on the PR team for sorghum. It has incredible, endless benefits in terms of sustainability, but it also is tightly woven into the culture of the South. So it, as a plant, it has two varietals, one that yields a grain that is used as flour or animal feed, and then another one that where the stalks are pressed to extract a juice that is then boiled down into a syrup, not unlike how we make molasses. And this sorghum syrup is a very, very popular Southern ingredient. Did you know about that?
I did not.
I didn't either.
I didn't know anything about it.
Until I started, I know. I didn't either until I started to research it more. And slowly, sorghum syrup has taken the place of cane sugar molasses in all of my baking.
Can you, when you're using these ancient grains, can you substitute them for the entire recipe, for the entire flour recipe, or do you need to do like half and half or less even?
That's a great question. So the simple answer to this question is yes, you can, but you'll have to exercise good judgment because as soon as you start learning about the properties of each individual grain, you'll notice that you'll have to make certain adjustments. So for example, buckwheat, one of my favorite ancient grains, is totally gluten-free, just like sorghum. So depending on what you are preparing with it, you might have to compensate with a little bit of a glutinous flour, like all-purpose flour, or even an heirloom wheat flour, like Sonora flour is a very popular flour here in Los Angeles because we have a good supply of it and an excellent miller that offers it to the public.
Well, why do you do that? Why do you need gluten in your baked dishes?
So gluten at the end of the day is a protein present in a lot of grains, but specifically or especially in wheat. And it it's that that protein that allows the flour to bind. So this binding characteristic is what makes bread happen, for example, or it is what helps a cake not fall apart, right? So as a baker, you have a lot of tricks to compensate for lack of gluten, but gluten is an important element in baking.
So would you recommend what, half and half or...
I'm a big fan of half and half. I'm a big fan of half and half. But however, if you go through many of the recipes in my book, you'll find that a lot of recipes call for a full-on 100% whole grain, ancient grain flour. A great grain that serves this purpose, for example, is spelt, which I like to call a gateway flour because it behaves very similarly to all-purpose flour. You can substitute it almost in every instance in a one-to-one fashion.
And it's a wheat. It's wheat-based, spelt.
And it's a wheat relative, yes.
Right. I have to say, it's a little intimidating just thinking about using these grains when, you know, we're not so familiar with them and we don't know how they operate in the kitchen.
What is really cool about, and I feel like when people really lose fear baking with whole grains is that what's really cool about these flowers is that these are flowers that look different, smell different, feel different. So they are completely captivating. Like when we are baking with whole grain flours, we are fully engaged in the process. More than anything, just out of curiosity. And in doing so, like every one of our senses is fully participant in the process. And it makes it a very mindful and purposeful activity. And what else could you want out of baking, if not that?
Well, you have definitely inspired me. So I'm gonna venture forth. I'm not gonna be afraid. I'm gonna try it.
You're gonna make some cake. I promise you that this will not be intimidating anymore.
Okay, good. I'm gonna hold you to that, Roxana. It has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been super fun.
That's Roxana Julepat. She's the head baker at Friends and Family. That's a bakery in East Hollywood. And her new cookbook is called Mother Grains, Recipes for a Grain Revolution. Coming up, when humans abandoned museums at the beginning of the pandemic, the bugs moved in. How the Getty went into overdrive to get rid of insects who wanted to feast on its priceless antiquities. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Museums across LA are slowly starting to reopen. But while the galleries were closed to humans for the last year, other guests crept in. Bugs, specifically moths. Moths are one of the biggest threats to a museum's precious objects like decorative silks and centuries-old furniture. At the Getty Museum in Brentwood, museum staff spent basically the entire year, they're calling it 6,000 hours, undertaking a massive moth remediation during the pandemic. Deborah Vankin wrote about this for the Los Angeles Times, where she writes about arts and culture. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great to have you. Well, how did the Getty discover that it had a moth problem?
Well, the Getty at any given time has about 50 to 55 moth traps around the museum, and they put them in places like throughout the galleries, in the storage facilities. And then there's an assistant conservator who makes weekly rounds and goes gallery to gallery checking the traps. And I find it kind of hilarious that one of the world's wealthiest museums, you would think they have this intricate pest management system, but in fact, they use these tiny little cardboard sticky traps that are sort of like roach motels. but the traps are, they look like little roach motels. The traps are primarily for detection purposes, so they can stay ahead of the problem. And in mid-April, the conservator, who normally in pre-pandemic times would find one or two moths in the traps, every couple of weeks or months, found a handful of them in one of the decorative arts galleries around an 18th century pink silk bed. And shortly thereafter, they found about 20 moths in another decorative arts gallery. And of course, the Dec Arts galleries are where all the textiles are that the moths like to feed on. Mm-hmm. So that's where the vulnerable objects were.
I can imagine that an 18th century pink silk bed is like, I don't know, for a moth diving into a big, huge fluffy cake, like delicious.
It was a feast of riches, literally, for the moth. It's the moth is called the webbing clothes moth, and it's a type of moth that feeds on silk and wood and wool, organic material. And so the wood upholstered furniture was, of course, something they went for, as were the tapestries that are made of silk and wool and the sort of hand knotted carpets from the 1660s. There's a ton of good stuff in there for them.
Just a feast, a smorgasbord for the moths. So normally, if people are around, they shoo the moths away, like the moths don't like to feast when people are around?
Yeah, I mean, that's what created the problem. Apparently, there was an uptick globally. I didn't know this till I started reporting the story, at museums and galleries in many parts of the world. And the reason is that they were shuttered to the public, and moths, a lot of insects, like dark and quiet spaces, and it's the light and the human activity that scares them away. And so when all the museums shuttered, at the beginning of the pandemic, it was like night at the museum. The bugs crept in.
So here they are having a party, and then the party is interrupted. So the Getty gets into high gear. What did they do to get rid of these pests?
Well, first they went into high gear planning mode, and they ordered all sorts of specialized supplies. And then crews, usually small crews because they were socially distanced, they first attacked the floors in the decorative arts galleries. There are about 16 of them, 16 galleries there. And they got down on their hands and knees and they sliced through every crack in every floorboard, gallery by gallery, cleaning essentially the dust in the floorboards because moths love to eat dust. The one other thing they did that I found really just incredibly interesting was that they had to take apart a lot of the furniture in the decorative arts galleries. And that means things like the Boule cabinet, which is largely considered one of the favorite objects at the entire Getty, not just in the Dec Arts galleries, but the whole campus. And it's a 17th century chest that was made for the French King Louis XIV. And it's incredibly intricate with an oak veneer and inlays of pewter and brass and tortoiseshell and ivory. And they had to deinstall it from the wall and the floor and then take it apart in pieces and then clean and dust each individual piece, then put it back together, then put it back on the wall, and then do that for every other object around the room and then every other gallery in the Dec Arts galleries.
Oh my gosh. Would they do this normally, or... I mean, this sounds like something that they would have to do periodically, normally, to get rid of the dust, because also people cause dust, because dust, to be disgusting about it, is made up of human cells. But it sounds like this is an extraordinary operation.
Yeah, the Getty does, like any museum or any institution, regular cleanings, I'm sure. So if they're finding one or two in a trap every couple weeks or months, what they might do in normal times is kind of inspect the area and then do a spot cleaning. So they dust and vacuum in that spot. But because they saw the uptick, they went into sort of high gear on this, you know, what they called a moth remediation program. But essentially that means a deep, deep cleaning that took basically a year.
And they put some of these precious silks and tapestries into freezer trucks. They actually froze them after they cleaned them.
Yeah, so that was another thing they did. In addition to cleaning the floors, they took all the textiles. So I think it was like a dozen tapestries and the rugs, and they froze them in order to kill off the moths, but also the larvae and the eggs. And they very carefully deinstalled them off the wall after vacuuming them with a specialized sort of bristle head brush. And then they very carefully rolled them and stacked them on cradles inside trucks, so that there wouldn't be any tension on the fibers, because these are really delicate, valuable textiles. And they froze them in batches of four for like 10 days in a freezer trailer that was on the Getty campus. And I just, that's another thing I find kind of funny, that while we were all quarantining our groceries at the start of the pandemic in the garage, the Getty was quarantining their textiles up to 10 days in a truck.
Well, I guess the Getty's preparing to reopen. I know the Malibu version is already open, but the Brentwood campus is preparing to reopen, they say, maybe by the end of May. And will all of these objects be back and everything will be back to normal?
They will. The moth program is right now at the very tail end. They're just finishing it up. They're doing some duct cleaning, and they're going to start to reinstall the tapestries and the other textiles. And I don't know exactly if everything will be in the same place. They might mix up where things are installed, the different rooms. It's a chance, I think, to mix things up and do things a little differently, reinstall the objects, which is fun. But they will be reinstalled, and I'm told the museum is opening in late May.
And after all of this was said and done, did they discover that they had an even bigger bug problem than they thought, or was it less, or what did they discover?
They didn't. I asked them that, and I think that they never thought that they had a huge bug problem. It's just that they say that they have a zero tolerance and that they were just seeing more than they normally would see. And because there was an uptick, and because other museums and galleries were seeing upticks as well, they wanted to get ahead of it. And so it was sort of a preventative measure to do this incredible deep cleaning. And they could do it because of the pandemic, because the museum was closed, whereas normally they wouldn't be able to do that if the museum was open to the public.
Deborah Venkin is arts and culture writer at the LA Times, where you can read her story about the Getty Museum's battle with the bugs. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
right, we are going to scuttle out of here like a bug. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever and wherever you want. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great rest of your day. I'll see you tomorrow.